declared it has used the heavy Falak 1 rocket to target the Ma'ali Golan barracks while also targeting the Kila post in the occupied Golan Heights in retaliation for Israel's aggressions in Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. Several secret headquarters, including the 91st Division in the Galilee region, and gatherings of soldiers were also under Hezbollah's fire. Experts believe the confrontation is moving in an ascending ladder of events.
The Israelis are attempting to put pressure on the resistance by changing the rules of engagement, and therefore have begun with targeted assassinations. The resistance is responding in accordance with its vision of this battle, and is ensuring that it remains limited to the border region where it has the upper hand.
Journalists and cameramen are always on high alert in case sounds of explosions are heard to get some glimpse of a battle which seems unpredictable. Yet as Israelis go further, so will the resistance. Sheikh Jihad Asadi is a resident of the southern town of Shaba, but was forced to live further away from his town, which has been partially occupied by the Israelis since after the 1967 war. He says he keeps an eye on the Shaba farms to watch resistance rockets hit their targets and believes it will one day be liberated.
Netanyahu says he will withdraw from Shaba farms if Hezbollah withdraws to the north of the Litani River. We tell him that it is he who has to withdraw from occupied Lebanese land. This is the beginning of the end of the Israeli regime, and we advise all the Zionist settlers not to remain on our land, even if a truce is in place.
Hezbollah has also targeted several Israeli drones and lately hacked and confiscated an Israeli Skylark drone.
With the scope of Israeli attacks amplifying, Hezbollah is flexibly adhering to the needs of the battlefield, whether in the quality or the quantity of their hits against Israeli targets or the armaments used. Maryam Saleh from Khiyam, South Lebanon.
An emergency protest outside the UK Prime Minister's office to try and stop an imminent massacre, called for by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and a coalition of other similar organizations.
Week after week, pro-Palestinian protesters have come out in huge numbers to demand that the British government call for a permanent, immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and to terminate its military and political support for apartheid Israel. And they're galvanized by the knowledge and hope that the pressure they're ramping up on the British government will eventually stir action.
In a sign of that pressure working, only hours before the protest, the UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron joined other European leaders to caution the Netanyahu regime to think twice about its mass incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which shelters 1.4 million displaced Palestinians.
We are very concerned about the situation and we want Israel to stop and think very seriously before it takes any further action. But above all, what we want is an immediate pause in the fighting. And we want that pause to lead to a ceasefire, a sustainable ceasefire, without a return to further fighting.
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
Hands off Gaza!
But while that may seem like a change in the UK government's tone, the protesters here say it doesn't go far enough.
What kind of disturbed and dystopian world are we in? We're asking for peace is become slander. I just do not understand. I cannot comprehend what more needs to be done. Do they need to see 1 million Gazans being exterminated on their TVs or drowning in the Mediterranean Sea? Because that is the options that Israel is giving them.
Another demand here, an end to UK arms sales to Israel. According to the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, between 2015 and 2022, the UK licensed more than $500 million worth of weapons to Tel Aviv. Saeed Purza, London.
It's a day off for Zayed, a computer science student in New Delhi, hailing from neighboring Uttar Pradesh state. He wants to pursue a career in New Delhi, saying finding job is like a battle in this part of the world. But he is disappointed with the fact that elections are due and nothing more is important for politicians rather than stoking religious sentiments.
The governments have their own agendas to stay in power and they want to win over and over again. So the easy tool is to exploit people on the issue of faith. India's people from all faiths and politicians want us to stay uneducated. so we won't question them on their policies. We should be talking about education, unemployment, healthcare, and good future for our next generation.
After the opening of a major Hindu temple in the town of Ayodhya last month, anti-Muslim sentiments are running high in India. In the Himalayan state of Uttarakhand, the demolition of a decades-old mosque and its seminary has led to deadly clashes. The violence is the latest incident of communal flare-up ahead of general elections. Muslim sites have become a new target of the right-wing Hindu groups. In recent weeks, top Muslim leaders urged the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi to end the religious dispute, citing a threat to communal harmony and calling for the protection of Muslim places of worship.
Since the BJP rule started in 2014, they are doing everything to destroy the country's secular credential. They are taking the country in the wrong direction by promoting Hindu first agenda to patronize the majority. But this country has a constitution which we trust and believe in. They raised a mosque in New Delhi last week, now in Haldwani, calling them illegal encroachment despite the fact they are decades old. They are selectively targeting a particular community, which is very unfortunate.
Experts say the demolitions are not confined to any particular region or state, but a deliberate attempt to demonize the Muslim community. Meanwhile, tensions have gripped the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh, Bareilly city, after the arrest of an Islamic cleric who had called for protests against the demolition of the mosque. Human rights groups have called on the Indian government to halt this bulldozer campaign. Critics accuse the Modi's government of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community. They allege the ruling party is stigmatizing its critics and adopting policies that legitimize violence against the religious minorities. The BJP denies the claims, saying equal rights for all is enshrined in Indian democracy.
General elections in India are due in May 2024. Observers say many polarizing issues, including those related to Muslims, are being hyped in both social and political domain to garner public attention in the Hindu-majority India, where religion is used for electoral gains. Rights groups have accused the ruling BJP of selectively targeting Muslims, their homes, places of worship and businesses, calling it a larger political agenda. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
The Iranian embassy in Yemen organized an event to mark the 45th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Senior Yemeni officials attended the ceremony to congratulate Iranian diplomats on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Look to the Islamic Revolution from a strategic point of view. It's the first revolution that spread regionally and internationally to promote Islam as a concept, as a religion, and at the same time to give some strength to the people of this region. If not for the Republic, Islamic Republic of Iran, you won't see that we have a very high and loud voice all over the world.
The Islamic Revolution in Iran was positive and prompted the wide sector of the nation to take action in the great civilizational battle between Islam and infidelity. Therefore, it is considered an inspiring revolution for many Muslim and non-Muslim nations.
Yemeni officials highlighted how the Islamic Revolution served as a source of inspiration for their people, leading them to reject American interventionist policies, a sense that culminated in the 2014 revolution in Yemen.
The Islamic Revolution was inspiring to many Arab peoples, but the regimes oppressed the peoples and frustrated them with the support of the United States. However, the Islamic Revolution endured for 45 years and achieved many of the aspirations of the people of Iran. Today, Iran has become a major regional power that is feared by all countries.
In recent years, Yemeni-Iranian relations have flourished, particularly amid the U.S.-backed war on Yemen. This war, sparked by the 2014 revolution, aimed to reinstate a former regime aligned with the U.S. in the country. Observers say that victories of the resistance movements across the region are the result of the rise of the Islamic Revolution. They believe that without the Islamic Revolution, the Palestinian resistance would not have been able to withstand the brutal Israeli war with such strength. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The 45th anniversary of Iran's Islamic Revolution is commemorated in the Iranian embassy in Kabul. The event was attended by officials from Afghanistan's Taliban administration and foreign diplomats from several countries. During the ceremony, Afghanistan's deputy foreign minister congratulated the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution to Iran's special representative and emphasized his country's willingness to broaden ties with Iran.
We must emphasize that the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan wants to broaden ties with neighboring countries, especially the Islamic Republic of Iran. We are committed to deepen our relations with Iran in political, cultural, security, and economic fields. Once again, we congratulate this anniversary and wish to see mutual relations expanding between the two nations.
One of the aspects of the effectiveness of Islamic Revolution in Iran lies within our foreign policy. In this regard, our government have made numerous efforts to expand relations with other countries. Accordingly, one of our main concerns has always been to establish peace in Afghanistan. Islamic Republic of Iran, following the emphasis of its leader, has on its agenda to help the people of Afghanistan and strengthen good neighborliness, dialogue, and communication with the Afghanistan's authorities.
People in many countries were inspired by the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and of course the Afghans were affected the most in 1979. The Islamic Revolution in Iran was a series of events that led to the overthrow of the Pahlavi dynasty in 1979. The revolution largely affected many Muslim nations around the globe as it marked a significant shift in the political dynamics of the West Asia. It is believed that Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 marked a pivotal moment in its history with far-reaching impacts. The revolution played a key role in shaping the geopolitical landscape of West Asia and continues to do so. Abdullah Mirzad, Kabul.
After a visit to Lebanon, Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus, where he met President Bashar al-Assad and discussed bilateral relations. President Assad warned that the U.S. supply of weapons to Israel threatens to expand the war in Gaza. Amir Abdullahian said the aggression against Gaza is considered the main issue at the regional and international levels, noting that Syria is in the front line of supporting the Palestinian people and their cause. Amir Abdullahian also met with his counterpart, Faisal Miqdad. They condemned the U.S. aggression on Syria, Iraq and Yemen, and the repeated Israeli attacks on Syria. They later held a press conference.
I discussed with President al-Assad the latest regional and international developments. The leaders of our two countries are willing to achieve remarkable progress through cooperation in various fields. President Ibrahim Raisi has extended an official invitation to President Assad to visit Iran. We condemn the illegal presence of U.S. forces in Syrian territory.
Our two countries share identical views concerning the support that should be given to the people in the Gaza Strip in light of the genocide perpetrated by the Israeli occupation. Syria has fought wars against the Israeli occupation and remains prepared to engage when necessary. But we decide the timing and approach. The repeated assaults by the Zionist entity on Syrian territories are a direct result of Syrian resistance against this entity.
The Iranian minister concluded by stating that the onslaught on Gaza must come to an end. This visit comes at a critical time to reaffirm the unity of the axis of resistance leadership in response to the escalating aggression by the U.S. and Israel, and to demonstrate the absolute support for the Palestinian people in Gaza. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Tragedy after tragedy, war crime after war crime, and the genocide continues. This is the description of what has been happening in Gaza since October the 7th. The Israeli regime continues trying to raise the bar on just how much it can torture Palestinians. The majority of the population of Gaza has been displaced, some of them many times as they were told to leave the north and head towards the middle and then to the south. And now as people have gone as far south as they can go, which is Rafah, the sadistic Israeli regime is threatening a ground invasion where almost 1.5 million people are located, and most of them in tents or in other temporary locations. So we're going to take a look at the latest of this genocide in Gaza on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Bahaimer Abu Saada, professor of political science, Al-Azhar University, Doha. And Paul LaRue, co-founder of Free Palestine Movement out of Berkeley. Thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start this off in Doha. Well, Muhammad, your thoughts on what the Israeli regime is trying to do, trying to accomplish at this point in time, in your perspective.
Well, many thanks, Marzia, for hosting me in your program. To be honest with you, as a Palestinian and also as a Palestinian who lived the Israeli war against Gaza at the beginning of it, it seems to me that Israel has gone crazy. The Israeli leadership, the Israeli army, the Israeli regime as a whole, they've lost their mind. What they are doing against the Palestinian people is beyond imagination. The magnitude of killing, the destruction, going after Palestinian children, women, civilians, destroying hospitals, clinics, and schools and universities, nothing has very much escaped the Israeli killing and the Israeli destruction. And now they are preparing the ground to go into Rafah, where they very much have pushed 1.4 million Palestinians from the north of Gaza and also the central refugee camps of the Gaza Strip into the south city of Rafah. And as we have heard yesterday, that Netanyahu gave the orders to the Israeli army to prepare for the ground invasion of Rafah, where, as I mentioned, there is 1.4 million Palestinians in tents. Most of them are living in tents with little food, with little potable water, and that's going to be the mother of all tragedies. That's going to be the mother of all Palestinian Nakbas if the Israeli army goes into Rafah with this large population in a very small piece of territory, which is 62 square kilometers. That is the territory of Rafah, and usually Rafah is a house of is housing roughly 350,000 Palestinians.
Right.
But
right.
Now there is 1.4 million Palestinians there. It seems to me that Israel is trying to make one thing, punish the Palestinians collectively. That's what Israel has been doing for the past 4 months, going after the they're going after Hamas, but they are not going only after Hamas. They're going after the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. That
okay.
is collective punishment.
Stay with me, Mohammed.
That is genocide against the Palestinian people.
Stay with me. Let me get Paul in on this conversation, this discussion. Now, none of the goals that the regime announced in the beginning for going into Gaza has been met, Paul. Zionist forces have not destroyed Hamas, nor have they been able to free any of the captives, but of course, they have been successful in killing many kids, infants, women, and in general, civilians. And they have destroyed much of the infrastructure. Your take, were these the actual goals to begin with?
I think that's the main goal. I think they intended to use the Hamas action to liberate Palestine. I think they'd intended to use that as a pretext for another Nakba, another genocide. Their objective is less about getting rid of Hamas because they know they can't. And because they know that if you get rid of Hamas, which is impossible, you simply have another resistance movement replacing it. I mean, the Palestinians, no people is ever going to give up their liberty and and accept the kind of prisoner relationship with Israel that Israel was demanding. And in fact, Israel doesn't care about a prisoner relationship. From the beginning, since 1897, you could even say 1895, the objective of Israel has been to eliminate the Palestinians. And so they're using this as a way to achieve that. I think their objective is not to punish Palestinians, it is to eliminate Palestinians. That is the entire, the beginning and the end of their objective in Gaza and the rest of Palestine.
Well, Muhammad, Palestinians not only have to deal with the bombings and targeted sniper killings and relocation and starvation, but there's also another aspect, which is the psychological torture. The regime is constantly flying drones overhead with a constant humming sound to let everyone know that they are there and can be killed at any moment. I want to talk about that side of things. And in your perspective, why is this regime so inhumane?
Well, Marzia, I have a mother who is in Rafah. I have brothers and sisters and nephews and nieces and many relatives who are in Rafah, and I talk to them every now and then to try to make sure that they are okay and they are fine. It's not only the bombing and the pounding of the Gaza Strip. In addition to that, the starvation. Israel is not is allowing only a very limited amount of food and water for the Palestinians. Lack of medical supplies. It's the cold weather that also is killing and making Palestinian children sick as a result of the very cold weather that the Palestinian people are facing in Rafah with no homes, living in tents. And it seems to me that it's all of that. In addition to all of that, yes, the Palestinian people cannot escape Israeli snipers. Not only in Rafah, but all over the Gaza Strip. There are Israeli snipers in the north, in Gaza City, in Khan Yunis, where very much they shoot at anything that moves. We have seen over the past few days that Israeli army, snipers of the Israeli army killed Palestinians in Gaza City around the Shifa Hospital. They killed Palestinians in Khan Yunis around the Al-Amal Hospital, which is in Khan Yunis, and Nasser Hospital, where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinians displaced, went to these hospitals seeking protection, seeking safe places. But there is no safe place, unfortunately, in Gaza. So it's just it's a atrocity after atrocity, and the number is rising. We're talking about now almost more than 100,000 Palestinians are either dead, missing, or wounded as a result of this Israeli massacre against the Palestinians. We're talking roughly about 4% of the Palestinians in Gaza are affected, as I mentioned, dead, injured, or missing as a result of what's going on. Right. And unfortunately, all of this is happening under the watch of the international community.
Yes, I want to stay with me. I want to actually stay with me, Muhammad, because I want to touch on that aspect of it a little bit. Well, Paul, as you heard about the ground invasion that Netanyahu is calling for in Rafah, and as Muhammad had said, if you're talking about a population that before was about 280,000, now 1.4 million, as Netanyahu is telling them to leave. I mean, where are these people supposed to go? What are they supposed to do?
As far as Israel is concerned, they don't have to go anywhere. They can be killed right where they are. They can be exterminated. And in fact, I think the count that we are hearing from the Ministry of Health in Gaza is a gross underestimate of the dead and wounded. Right now, Palestinians are dying without being counted. They are starving to death. They are dying of disease because of the cold and because of the bad water and because of the lack of sewage services and the filth and the and they're dying from exposure because they don't even have, we call them tents, but they're not really tents. They're just scraps of material that have been used to create tents, and they're dying from all of these things. And the Ministry of Health is not really counting them, nor can they count them. After all, if a family member is extremely ill and dying, are Palestinians going to take them to a hospital that doesn't exist, that is doesn't have services to offer them? No, they die anonymously in the middle of nowhere, and they get buried on the side of the road, wherever family members and volunteers from the community can bury them. There are mass graves all over Gaza now. In all sorts of places. I think the statistics are gross underestimates, and that this problem will increase a lot. The only way we'll know how many people in Gaza have died and from various Israeli inducements to death through cutting off resources and letting them die of starvation and disease is by waiting until the end of this and then counting the population afterwards and comparing it to what it was before October 7th. That's the only way we'll ever find out. And I think the result is going to be terrifying. It'll be horrible. Right.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mohaima, with Netanyahu openly announcing his intention for the regime to invade Rafah, you mentioned the international community. Let's talk about that side of the things. He has said his intention. We know that 1.4 million people are basically trapped in this area without any protection. And yet, basically, the regime has been given the green light by the U.S. and its accomplices, along with the U.N., to kill, to torture, to maim, until basically it seems that there's no Palestinian left. Your take on this so-called international community at this point in time?
Well, first of all, Marzia, let me say that maybe what Netanyahu is trying to do now by preparing the ground to invade Rafah is trying to put pressure on the Palestinian resistance to give up on its conditions with regard to the so-called prisoner exchange deal with Israel, and with regard to the conditions that put forward by Hamas. But if that military pressure doesn't work, then at the end of the day, there is nothing going to prevent Netanyahu from invading Rafah, because he has already invaded, let's say, more than 80% of the Gaza Strip, the north, the central area of Gaza. Khan Yunis is now under heavy Israeli pounding and bombardment. Now, going back to your question, it's just so sad that all of this is happening under the watch of the international community. And the only thing that we hear from the UN, from Israel, from the EU, that they are worried about Israeli plans to invade Rafah. They are worried about the number of Palestinians who are being killed. That's what we hear. Unfortunately, this is not enough. We've seen how the U.S. and EU have dealt with other countries who invaded their neighbors. Mainly, I'm talking about Russia. Nothing is compared when it comes to what Israel is doing against the Palestinians. And by the way, the number of Palestinians who have been killed, especially Palestinian children, is like way many times than the number of Ukrainian children who have been killed in 2 years, for example. But the international community, meaning the U.S., EU, and many countries, have boycotted Russia and put like a number of economic and financial sanctions. But none of that has happened. And just to say that the international community is worried, that's not enough. That's not helping the Palestinians. That isn't protecting the Palestinians from the genocide that is taking place in the Gaza Strip. And I wish really we really see some serious steps taken to prevent Israel, to put enough pressure on Israel to stop the genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Well, Paul, whole families have been wiped out, infants haven't been spared, and the injured in hospitals have received no mercy, nor have the doctors from the Israeli forces, which have targeted all, young and old. I mean, what does it take to call what we're seeing a genocide by the so-called international community? I mean, what does it take to call out all of these war crimes by that same so-called international community?
There's an American writer by the name of Upton Sinclair who was a fighter for the poor and disenfranchised at the opening of the 20th century. And he said, it's nearly impossible to make a man understand something that he's paid not to understand. And that's the case with the international community today. The international community is being paid by the United States, in effect, not to understand what is happening there, not to pronounce the word genocide, not to condemn Israel. It's all a matter of coercion by a very racist and aggressive international policy from the United States leading the West. This is what's happening here. I don't think that Hamas is going to change anything because of the genocide that Israel is perpetrating on the Palestinians, because they know that the Israel's intention, whether they compromise or don't compromise, is still going to be genocide. And so what's the good reason for doing that? Furthermore, the genocide that Israel is practicing is driving Palestinian young men to be fighters with Hamas. Hamas is getting stronger as time goes on. And Israel is really a basket case. They're economically, they're falling apart, and they're losing soldiers that is very difficult for Israel, which they can't stand to lose soldiers. They can't have to have captives in the hands of Hamas and the Palestinian resistance. So and 500,000 Israelis have already left the country, and we know that they're living with 300,000 refugees from the north of occupied Palestine to the south. So businesses are failing in despite the money that the United States is pouring into Israel. If I had to put my money on an outcome of what's happening there, I'd put it on Hamas and the resistance. I think they are winning this.
Right. Well, Mohammed, interesting what Paul said. He puts it on the resistance because, I mean, basically we see what is happening to the Israeli regime, that it is coming apart at the seam. But at the same time, it continues to create so many different tragedies inside of the Gaza Strip. We saw the body of 6-year-old Hind, the little girl who was missing for 2 weeks after calling the emergency number to report her father being targeted in their car, and it was found the emergency unit, which was looking for her, was also targeted, and the vehicle they found was just mangled iron steel with no one surviving. I mean, there's so many stories, so many tragedies, that just one of them would be enough, usually, for a so-called civilized international community to call this regime out. What else has to happen to stop this sadistic regime and call it out for the Holocaust that it is committing?
You know, it's good that you brought up the issue of Hind and her family. And you know what? The sad thing is that the Palestinian Red Crescent, who went to save Hind, they went with coordination. There was supposed to be a coordination between the Red Cross, who coordinated for the Palestinian Red Cross with the Israeli army to go and save Hind. And unfortunately, Hind was missing for many days, and the Palestinian Red Crescent who went to save her were also missing. And we just knew about it today that Hind is dead with all of her family members. And the Palestinian Red Crescent workers who went to save her are also dead. It seems to me that Israel has crossed all lines. Nothing is stopping Israel from committing such crimes, which again are happening under the watch of the international community. And I guess even the measures which the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, has asked Israel to do about 2 weeks ago, Israel has not implemented those measures. Israel is—I don't even know whether Israel is going to report to ICJ a month after these measures were supposed to be in place. It seems to me, with the impunity that has been provided to Israel by very much the U.S. and many Western countries, Israel believes that it has the right to do whatever it wants against the Palestinian people, and it feels that it can escape punishment. It feels that it has the impunity to do what it wants under the pretext that the 7th of October supposedly was carried out inside Israeli territory, and that killed 1,200 Israelis and took 240 Israeli hostages. The Israeli reaction, which even President Biden, the U.S. president, said yesterday that the Israeli retaliation against the Palestinian has even gone more than anyone has ever imagined. So even the U.S. started to speak out against this Israeli disproportionate use of force, which is, in my opinion, it's a genocide.
So sorry, I'm just about out of time, Mohammed. Paul, do you think that we're witnessing the collapse of the whole liberal system as their hypocrisy has been exposed to the whole world and they're refusing to stop this genocide? How do you see it?
I think this is correct, and it's not due just to the genocide in Gaza, but also they're losing on every front you can imagine. Ukraine in Europe is another front on which the so-called liberal democracies of the West are floundering. The world is changing, and unfortunately, it's very painful to watch it changing. It's not changing in a cooperative way, we could say. The old order is of colonialism and Western domination and a bipolar or unipolar world is dying, and that death will first be projected onto other peoples like the Palestinians and the Ukrainians and others. This is very sad to see, but unfortunately, it's necessary for the birth of a new world, which we hopefully, at least our children will see, my children anyway.
And on that note, thank you both for being with us here on the Spotlight. Mukhaibar Abu Saad, the professor of political science at Al-Azhar University, Doha, and Paul Arudi, co-founder of Free Palestine Movement out of Berkeley. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
from east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, local authorities and charities are urging the government to extend its Household Support Fund scheme, which was first introduced in autumn of 2021 and distributed among local councils to help those in need during the cost of living crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of iNews has covered this story and tells us more. UK councils warned free school meals during holidays will likely be withdrawn for hundreds of thousands of school pupils after Easter due to the end of government funding. Local authorities and charities are urging the government to extend its Household Support Fund scheme, which was first introduced in autumn of 2021 and distributed among local councils to help those in need during the cost of living crisis. Originally set to last until spring of 2022, the scheme had been extended three times, taking the total amount of funding to £2.5 billion, while England was given a further £842 million in April of 2023 in order to support those in need. However, the fund was not mentioned in the autumn statement by the Chancellor and is now due to come to an end on 31st of March. The scheme has been used by local councils to fund free school meal vouchers during the holidays, which has become a lifeline for low-income families during and since the pandemic, and takes up much of the money local authorities receive through the scheme. Beverly Craig, leader of Manchester City Council, said, "It is heartbreaking to think that her local authority will no longer be able to fund free school meal vouchers and other cost of living support when the fund comes to an end." She said, "We're a city that has historic levels of poverty and deprivation, often overlooked. Over 43% of our kids are growing up in poverty. Council analysis has shown that 20% of Manchester residents have a disposable income of less than £30 a month after rent, food and bills." Beverly Craig said, "Last year alone, the city spent over £50 million alleviating poverty and dealing with the cost of living crisis," adding that the council has been assisted this year by a Household Support Fund grant of £12.9 million. Councillor Craig said that this has enabled the council to help 60,000 people, including 40,000 children, receiving free school meal vouchers outside of term time, 12,500 vulnerable households getting cost of living support payments, 6,000 children benefiting from a holiday activity fund, and 400 care leavers accessing a boost to their income. Beverly Craig said, "So for a city like us, losing out on the Household Support Fund, it really is a problem. The 60,000 people that we're able to support in addition to all of the work that we're doing around poverty stops overnight." She added, "We're seeing vulnerable families who had a little bit of money tucked away for a rainy day have spent the rainy day money." Manchester City Council is calling for a year-long extension to the Household Support Fund, considering that economic forecasts suggest that the situation may have improved slightly by this time next year. But obviously, there's a longer-term discussion that this should be mainstreamed into budgets. Bella Sankey, the leader of Brighton and Hove City Council, which together with councils in Plymouth, Lambeth, Bristol and Southampton, has written to the government to stress the importance of the Household Support Fund, said that She has been horrified by what she has seen and heard in local food banks. She said, demand is now out of control, completely outstripping supply, like nothing that has ever been experienced before. The amount of discretionary food vouchers we would previously give out over the course of a year during COVID now goes out the door in just 1 month. She added, the concern is that people are clearly going without food, adding that the situation could potentially be having an impact on school attendance, as she has heard from one parent who was terrified about their child going to secondary school and needing to find the money to pay their bus fare. She said, those are the sorts of calculations and decisions people are having to make. Graham Witham, the Chief Executive Officer of Greater Manchester Poverty Action, said that the Household Support Fund has been really important, adding that the Free School Meals Council have been able to provide during holidays has helped build a safety net for families. Graham Witham said, the other side of it is that councils themselves are cash-strapped and don't have a significant ring-fence funding for welfare provision. So this has just been massive. It's enabled councils to stand up to responses to need that they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And it's created some space for innovation as well. He said he believes that historically government has washed its hand of local welfare provision, but that the Household Support Fund helped it to understand the value of the role that local authorities have. Graham Witham, the CEO of Greater Manchester Poverty Action, sees the end of the funding as a big cliff edge because cost of living support payment from the government ends in March as well. He called for permanent ring-fence funding for local welfare provision by local councils. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Lynn Perry, the chief executive of the British charity Barnardo's, said, across the United Kingdom, families are struggling to pay their bills or feed their children, often borrowing money and taking on debt just to get through another week. It's vital that the Household Support Fund continues. Lynn Perry added, the fund ends in March of 2024, so time is running out. Without renewal, it will leave a major hole in local crisis support. Leeds City Council Executive Member for Communities, Mary Harland, said the situation is looking pretty grim without the Household Support Fund, adding that, despite being an economically vibrant city, we do still have something like 22% of our population living in poverty, including 35,000 individuals or one in five children. She said, the Household Support Fund has helped Leeds City boost what it offers through its welfare support scheme, which provides food and fuel vouchers, white goods and help with building maintenance, adding that it is a vital scheme. Gespil, an organisation which works with vulnerable young people across the city, told the local council that it had been able to top up the gas meter of a family living in one of the most deprived areas of the city of Leeds, who had not had heating for several weeks and whose children had been off school with colds and other illnesses. A report published recently by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation found that informal carers are 8% more likely to be living in poverty than those with no caring responsibilities, at 28% compared to 20%. Dominic Carter, Director of Policy and Public Affairs at Carter's Trust, said, we need to think about what the Household Support Fund being taken away might mean for people like that. What else will they have to go without? We know that for a large number of unpaid carers, they put family members first, often to the detriment of their own health and their own well-being. It comes as council leaders have also called for reform of local government finance and an end to short-term measures after Community Secretary Michael Gove confirmed authorities will receive £500 million in emergency funding for for social care.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines: the Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli forces have kidnapped nearly 24 of its medical staff and patients at the Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis.